It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Superintendents from Wisconsin's five largest school districts are asking state lawmakers to work together to find a bipartisan solution to increase school funding.
School leaders from Madison, Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, and Green Bay wrote the open letter. It calls on the legislature and Governor Evers to return to annual per-pupil funding increases that are tied to the cost of living.
Wisconsin previously had that funding system in place under Governor Tommy Thompson, but it was eliminated in 2009 during the Great Recession.
The school districts say the current funding formula is not sustainable and will start to harm students over time.
We're taking a closer look at these funding issues and the state politics involved with Corrine Hess, WPR's education reporter. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What prompted this open letter from the superintendents of the five largest school districts in our state?
So as you both just mentioned, public school districts have not had a cost of living increase in 17 years. This has caused these superintendents and school leaders across the state to have to cut staff, consolidate schools, delay building maintenance. And so at this point, they've decided to come together to say, you know, they need more money.
Is it unusual for these districts to send a unified letter?
I really haven't seen this much in the past, so it is pretty unusual.
For your story, you spoke to a few of the superintendents who signed on to the letter, including Green Bay Superintendent Vicki Beyer. And let's listen to what she said about her frustration with the politicization of education funding in Wisconsin.
I'm really waiting for the adults to come to the room and start talking seriously about how we're going to fund public ed in Wisconsin. And that was part of the catalyst of this letter. We are just trying to provide solutions and asking them to please work bipartisanly to better our communities.
We're trying to provide solutions, Beyer says. What are the superintendents proposing with this letter?
So the state has a $4 billion surplus, and what these superintendents want is some of that money to be used to increase general state aid for public schools. This latest state budget did not increase state aid for public schools.
And why is the letter coming out now when the budget was passed more than 6 months ago? What is the timing here?
So when the budget was passed, the Republicans agreed to increase the reimbursement rate for special education costs. That rate was, it was pretty low. Governor Evers asked for a 60% increase. Republicans agreed to 42%, which was significant. But then in November, the Department of Public Instruction let schools know that the appropriations would actually only cover about 35% of the costs. Schools had already done their budgets for the year. So this was a shock to schools. And so, you know, now they're coming back and they're saying this is just not going to work for them.
You know, here on our show last week, we spoke with Republican Representative Senate President Mary Felskowski. And, you know, one thing that stood out from that conversation, she was basically saying, you know, telling districts to tighten your belts. You talked with some of these superintendents on the phone yesterday. How did that sit with them?
It doesn't sit well. You know, they say they've done the belt tightening. They have, you know, right now they're telling me all they can do is open up the buildings and try to retain staff, that they've already made the cuts. They've gone to the communities several times to try to get referendums passed, and they can't keep doing that. They need help from the state is what I'm hearing.
You know, districts are going to voters, as you said, to raise tax levies. Can you give us an idea of the scale of these operational referenda that we've seen on ballots in recent elections?
They're high. You know, Milwaukee passed one in 2024 that was over $200 million. Madison passed two in their school district that was over $600 million. That was for operations and capital projects. And these superintendents know that voters are tired of passing referendums. The Marquette poll showed that voters are tired of referendums. And so I think superintendents know that they can't keep going back and asking taxpayers to help just sustain these budgets.
We're talking with WPR education reporter Corey Hess about a group of Wisconsin superintendents from the five largest districts in the state calling on state lawmakers to compromise on school funding increases and sending a unified open letter. Corey, can you explain the partial veto that Governor Evers did in the last budget and the per pupil funding increases that were locked in for 400 years by the governor's veto?
So this was a school funding mechanism that allows school districts to increase about $300 per pupil. And the superintendents say this was a nice gesture of support, but it's not enough because it's not a cost of living increase. And what it has become is a political sticking point because Republicans are saying they're not going to negotiate to give schools more money until this 400-year kind of maneuver by the governor is removed. So what it is now is it's just become politics. And so that's where they're at. And that's why the superintendents have put out this letter and they're saying, please, politicians, come to the table and let's figure out something else.
And these superintendents, they're calling for funding increases that are tied to cost of living. Can you go deeper there? How significant of a change would that be financially for the district budgets if it was tied to cost of living?
You know, in talking to the Madison superintendent, he's saying that they've lost out on several million dollars a year. And this has been 17 years. So it would be very significant. And they're talking to me about stuff, you know, they're saying that inflation has hit them just like it's hit regular homeowners. You know, they're saying cost to heat the building, cost to feed the kids, healthcare costs. So it would be significant.
One of the tensions here is that the state is sitting on this significant budget surplus, you know, and it exists as extra money to spend once versus a request for recurring costs that might not always have this surplus available to fund. How big of an obstacle do you foresee that being with the budget surplus and one-time money?
I think it could. You know, I think if they come to the table, it could maybe not be as big of an obstacle. Speaker Voss signaled that he would be willing to talk, and both and Governor Evers did too. He was on your show last week, and he says that he thinks that there's enough money for both school relief and property tax relief. And I know Republicans want to use this money for taxes, so you know, maybe not as big as it looks right now.
Okay, one other line in this open letter, one of the other asks by the superintendents is for increasing the special education reimbursement rate. And in the letter, they said the funding promised in the state budget is unlikely to be upheld. Why is that?
So late last year, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau showed that the school districts ended up spending more on special education than they thought. So there just wasn't as much money as originally estimated.
Okay. I want to turn. So basically now with this open letter, have the superintendents received any reaction from state lawmakers or otherwise? What's been the reaction?
This went out on Friday afternoon, and I reached out to Republican leaders yesterday, and I did not hear back. So as far as I know, they have not.
Okay. So we will be watching that. Meanwhile, you have also been reporting over the weekend about UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin leaving to take over as president at Columbia University. Do you think this move came as a surprise to UW-Madison?
I don't think it was a complete surprise. She's been at UW-Madison for almost 4 years. Her father was a professor at Harvard, and her husband, who's a political science professor, is from New York. Studies show most chancellors leave after about 5 years. So I don't think anyone expected that she would finish her career at Madison. Maybe, you know, leaving now might have been a bit of a surprise.
Mnookin has navigated UW-Madison through controversies over DEI funding, as well as the pro-Palestine protests. How do those issues shape her legacy in that role as chancellor?
You know, higher education has had two very tumultuous years across the country. And yesterday, several people came out with statements about Dr. Mnuchin's performance, including Governor Evers and Speaker Voss, who both praised her for how she's navigated these tough issues at UW-Madison.
What will be some of the top issues that Mnuchin's replacement will be on their to-do list when they take over as the new chancellor?
So the university just announced that it now ranks fifth in the nation for research expenditures. And this is the first time it's ranked that high since 2014. So I'm guessing that they will want to continue that. That's a huge accomplishment. She's done a lot to make sure that students, Wisconsin students, can afford to go to UW-Madison. I would guess that they want to continue that. So I think that those are some top issues.
What do you know about the timeline for her departure, and what is the process for replacing her as chancellor?
Chancellor Mnuchin plans to stay through the spring commencement, and UW System President Jay Rothman says he plans to appoint an interim chancellor soon, and then the Board of Regents will begin a national search.
Corey, thank you so much for the update on these education stories. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Corey Hess is an education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She was with us to share her reporting first on school superintendents from the five largest districts in Wisconsin calling on state lawmakers to find a better compromise for school funding in the state. And then we spoke about Chancellor Mnuchin headed to Columbia University and the replacement for the top chancellor position at UW-Madison.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, in a state where marijuana remains illegal, UW-Platteville enrolls students in its online cannabis education program. Hear from the California firm that provides that training.
There is a lot of need and desire and demand for people to get involved in this industry, whether it's right now or in the coming future.
That's ahead here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Milk prices are now below many dairy farmers' break-even points after a steady price decline since January of last year.
It is the latest symptom of a volatile milk economy that's pushed some farmers to open side businesses to stay afloat.
Harvest Public Media's Tadeo Ruiz-Sandoval reports.
Quincy Schmidt's family has owned their dairy farm in Corcoran, Minnesota, an hour outside of the Twin Cities, since 1958, when her grandpa first scouted the area.
He hopped in his pickup one day, and he bought the farm with 20 cows and a horse, and we kind of have grown our farm from there.
When Schmidt was growing up, the family had about 50 cows. And the herd expanded over time.
As we became adults and were interested in the farm, we increased our herd. We're now milking 120 cows, and yeah, they're pretty friendly. They're a friendly bunch.
But for the past 5 years, dairy prices have been volatile. They're currently running a few dollars below many farmers' break-even points. Profit margins at Schmidt's family's farm started shrinking.
Dairy isn't always a consistent form of income. If other dairy farmers can relate, the prices are pretty low. They've been very low for a while. It's not always the same check you see coming in every. It's not a consistent check.
Thus, their side business, Curious Cows and Company, was born. For $25, visitors can spend 30 minutes snuggling calves, brushing their coats, or feeding them hay. I tried filming myself cuddling with cows, in fact, until one of them thought my hair was edible. In the business. Ah!
But why have dairy prices been declining? One part of it is that there's a dairy glut that's outpacing demand. Christopher Wolf is an ag economist at Cornell University. He says people tend to consume a lot of these dairy products when they eat out.
They're more likely to, people eat more cheeses, more specialty cheese in particular, and things like that when they eat out.
But he says with inflation still relatively high, people are eating out less, and that cuts into dairy consumption.
So right now, inflation is still being kind of stubborn, and everything that's happening right now doesn't look like it's going to do much for curbing inflation. So when people go out less, it also has impacts.
Which is precisely why dairy businesses across the country have delved into agritourism and diversified their product lines to generate as much revenue as possible. This isn't a new idea to Jeff Swanson, a tour manager at Country Dairy in Michigan.
That's part of the reason why we put in our own bottling plant, because in the late 70s and early 80s, milk prices were really low and a lot of farmers were selling out.
Country Dairy not only bottles its own milk, but also operates its own ice cream line, offers tours, and even has a small restaurant on its farm. Swanson says the idea of the special products and tours is also about helping people to understand farming.
People who really have a disconnect with farms today, to be able to educate them and help them know what a modern dairy farm is like.
Swanson says this has allowed their farm to remain relatively independent from major milk market forces. Their focus is to provide quality milk to their customers and offer some unique time on the farm.
So this year, we're also going to be doing classes on Thursdays, and we call it Moo University or Moo U, and we are doing that to try and open up farming even more to people.
That's been a recurring theme through conversations with different dairy farmers. These side businesses aren't just about bringing in more cash. They're also meant to connect people. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms across the Midwest and Great Plains, including WPR. It's Wisconsin Today. Continuing education students at UW-Platteville are now able to enroll in online cannabis education courses to earn a certificate, and that coursework is underway.
In partnership with the California-based cannabis education firm Greenflower, students can learn about cultivation, compliance, and safe usage.
Platteville is located less than 20 miles from the Illinois border, where marijuana is legal. But what does this certificate program mean to Wisconsin residents where marijuana is illegal, and how could it impact our state's workforce?
To look into those questions, we turn to Aaron Withrow, program manager at UW-Platteville's Continuing Education Institute. Aaron, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Why offer these classes in a state where marijuana is illegal in Wisconsin?
So this program that we offer with Greenflower is not about promoting cannabis use. It's the focus on education and being responsible for industry practices. We make sure that we have our subject matter experts in the room teaching these courses, and being a close proximity to Iowa and Illinois having those legalities different from the other states, we want to make sure that we are offering things that our region's looking for.
Yes. And so to talk more about that, Platteville, close to the border of Illinois, how do you envision Wisconsin students using these certificate skills?
Because it is in close proximity, we do have people that live in Wisconsin and work in Illinois. So it's not just necessarily Wisconsin residents. It's people who can live in either state that cross over, and just being a resource and advocating for what people are looking for.
Can you talk more about that? Because this latest cohort isn't the first cannabis education coursework that UW-Platteville has offered. How is this curriculum changing?
Well, it's all still through Greenflower. So we've never offered our own cannabis education. We've never claimed to be any of that. Previous predecessors actually met with Greenflower first. I'm just been graciously grandfathered in to work with these fine people. And so for us, it's not this new cohort for that we're offering with Greenflower is for better usage of people's times and resources. And they've really looked into the time that people are looking to take in all this information, the investment that they want to make, and then also what industry leaders are looking for with people that are taking that initiative to want to learn the industry the correct way.
What has demand been like for these types of classes?
For Platteville, the number that had originally started with number of students started stronger, and through the last couple, like the last year, it's kind of slowed down, which is why Greenflower looked at what they were offering for their students and what the industry was looking for. And that's part of why they did this new cohort of realigning what classes they're offering, what type of certificates are being distributed, and also the content of those courses.
So there aren't really any legal concerns with offering a certificate course like this in Wisconsin, where marijuana is illegal. Is that right?
Correct. It's, again, it's not promoting cannabis. It's promoting the education behind it. So it's not like we are saying, you know, to push that product. We're just saying we want to make sure that those that are interested, or those that are within the industry lines or looking to join that industry, have the necessary equipment that they need.
Is UW-Platteville's continuing education filling a gap in Wisconsin where this education hasn't been provided?
Well, I know Stevens Point, University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point offers a cannabis program, but this one's more focused for our workforce development, for the adult learner who is already in an industry of some kind or looking to get out of one and joining another, or also, you know, within that medical field, like you mentioned before, just to learn more about what, the, you know, how to serve their patients, or how to serve a need that they're looking for, and just making sure that we provide them with what they need.
We've seen a number of polls come and go through the Wisconsin legislature, or I'm sorry, we've seen a number of bills coming, you know, through the state legislature attempting to legalize recreational marijuana, medicinal marijuana. And then the polling shows many Americans are overwhelmingly supportive of marijuana legalization. Is UW-Platteville trying to get ahead of the curve on this with perhaps a potential legalization in the future?
I think it's just better to be ready to go, right? I mean, in my lifetime and in yours, I'm sure cannabis has not been, you know, it's always been there. It's not going anywhere. And I think the more that we stay ahead of it, and with those that want to make sure that it is, you know, cultivated successfully, and that it, you know, that you do have your industry standards in place, just like anything else that you consume, we want to make sure that there are regulations and that those are being followed. And so I think Max and Greenflower have been great with putting their subject matter experts in the right room, putting the right people in the right room to make sure that their education that they provide is exactly what those people are looking for. And I think that that only makes it stronger when those, you know, legislation discussions happen. And so it doesn't hurt us to be ready for it if and when it happens.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That is Erin Withrow, Program Manager at UW-Platteville's Continuing Education Institute. Now we hear from the cannabis education company Greenflower that is partnering with UW-Platteville on this certificate coursework. Max Simon is CEO. Max, welcome.
Good to be with you.
I understand most of the courses that Greenflower offers are on workforce development, such as how do you cultivate, how do you sell cannabis? Why do you focus on this aspect of the industry?
Oh, because that's where the jobs and the opportunities are. The cannabis industry is one of the fastest growing job sectors in the United States. It's also very complex, very heavily regulated, very nuanced, and as you know, comes with decades and decades of stigma attached to it. And so all of these environments are really perfect for teaching people the updated rules, the updated understanding, the updated industry, so that they can participate in this very fast growing new sector.
Rules are changing at the federal level. They change in many state houses at the state level. Does your curriculum have to basically continue to be updated with these types of changes?
All the time. You know, there's federal rules, there's state rules, and if you can believe it, there's also local municipality rules. And then on top of that, there are rules for each different kind of cannabis company. They are licensed differently and have different regulations and safety requirements for each. So it's a quite complex curriculum. This is one of the things that people are surprised about is, you know, you always joke it's just a bunch of people that like weed taking these programs. But the reality is it's a very complex, very regulated industry that really requires deep understanding to participate.
You've been offering these types of courses for over a decade now. Wisconsin, though, a state you offer classes where marijuana is completely illegal, both recreational and medicinal. Do you have to adjust the material for Wisconsin students, you know, even though coursework is online?
So when I started offering these cannabis education programs, there was 4 states in the United States that was legalized. Hmm. And now, you know, you have most of the country that is legalized in one form or another. So the reason I say that is because we're very acutely aware of the fact that places like Wisconsin are still in a prohibitionist state of operations. But it doesn't mean that that can't change very quickly and that can't change with some new leadership and new momentum brought to the table. And so our attitude has been that we want to be in all the states because whether it's a cannabis education program or it's covering the hemp sector, which these programs also cover, there is a lot of need and desire and demand for people to get involved in this industry, whether it's right now or in the coming future.
In other states where marijuana is legal, how do students use this type of certificate?
Well, there's lots of ways. When companies are hiring in this day and age, they get anywhere between 50 to, I just spoke to somebody last week, they get up to 500 applicants per job posting.
Wow.
And it just shows you the demand. People really want to work in this industry. So how do you stand out? How do you become somebody that's trustworthy? How do you demonstrate that you have real credibility to bring? These certificate programs, you know, offered through UW-Platteville, give somebody a real sense of distinguished credibility that most others can't replicate. But on top of that, you know, you have to know where you want to play in this industry. So these programs give you direction, whether that means you want to become an entrepreneur or a service provider or a consultant. And they also tell you, yeah, what the opportunities are, either where you are or what's coming up next. And so we have lots of people who take these programs because they're looking for jobs. We have people that take these programs because they're looking to expand a business. Or we have people that are just entrepreneurial, looking to get ahead of the next wave of opportunity.
These are online, so there isn't that hands-on learning component. What would a student experience? Can you give an example of a course experience or a class experience?
Yeah. So we have basically 2 sets of programs. There's a foundational program called the Cannabis Associate, which people can take as a standalone program. It's only about 8 weeks, but it does go through each sector of the industry. You learn about cultivation, you learn about manufacturing, you learn about compliance, you learn about the state versus federal rules, you learn about the cannabis plant and the cannabis products, you learn about the fundamentals of what makes the cannabis industry something legitimate. And then from there, we have these 5 specialist programs, which are an additional 8 weeks. And their programs are in cultivation, product development, medical cannabis, compliance, and retail and sales. And in those programs, those are the specific sectors of the industry that there's jobs and opportunities. And so you learn about the nuances of cultivating cannabis, all the parts of the cannabis cultivation process, the different job opportunities that exist in the cannabis cultivation sector, cannabis compliance in the cultivation sector. And so it really, again, makes you a specialist in one of these particular high job growth areas so that you can go break into the industry as a next step.
You mentioned hemp for just a moment, and there are a number of bills, you know, in Wisconsin that are aimed at shoring up how hemp-derived products can exist, you know, under state law, separate from marijuana, which is illegal. What is your take on the hemp industry and how other states operate in this confusing legal landscape?
Yeah, my first take is that there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding, and this is one of the reasons why good, trustworthy education is so important. But the second thing is that as you've watched the hemp sector grow and evolve, you realize that the need for proper regulations, proper rules, and proper alignment is really important. And you don't always know where those rules and alignment are going to look and where things are going to end up. Sometimes it works for your favor, sometimes it works against your favor. And so in my opinion, first, I don't think the hemp bans are going to stick. I think that they're going to be overturned. And I think you're going to begin to see a more standardized state level and even federal framework for how these products are properly regulated. And so even though there's a bit of uncertainty now, I have very strong confidence that the near future, we're going to see some new levels of alignment that will give everybody clarity and confidence to be a part of the sector.
Before I have to let you go, Max, do you see educational growth, you know, for a certificate program that could one day become a baccalaureate degree, a bachelor's degree? What do you see as the future here?
I mean, candidly, I think that for the cannabis industry, these short form, very specialized programs are literally exactly what people need. They are not very expensive. They don't take a lot of time, and they train you for very specific roles in the industry. In my personal opinion, I think that's actually the future of most education. I think that education is becoming more specialized and is really there to serve the purpose of developing people's careers. So I believe in many ways what we're doing, even though it's cannabis-centric, is the next evolution of what education will look like that really serves people in a meaningful and ROI-driven way.
Max, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here with you.
That is Max Simon, CEO of Greenflower. It's a cannabis education company. Greenflower partnered with UW-Platteville to offer online cannabis courses to continuing education students. And earlier, we heard from Aaron Withrow, program manager at UW-Platteville's Continuing Education Institute, to hear about how these classes impact Wisconsin's workforce.
Coming up, a community darkroom in Appleton called Photo Op is keeping the art of film photography alive. Meet the people who run this nonprofit.
Our film development nights are a community favorite, and that's just a night where we all get together and develop our film together.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farad. When was the last time you took a roll of camera film to be developed? Were you able to find a local business to do the developing, or were major retailers like Walgreens the only option?
In 2023, Appleton's only photo and video store closed permanently. It had served the community for over 30 years.
Some local photographers decided to do something about it, banding together to create Photo Op, a nonprofit visual workspace in downtown Appleton.
At Photo Op, everybody from hobbyists to professional photographers are welcome to use the community darkroom and attend workshops.
The organization is committed to keeping the art of film photography alive at a time when people may be looking for a break from the digital world.
John Adams has worked in the film and video industry for more than two decades. He is a freelance assistant director and co-founder of Photo Op. And Char Brandis is a hobbyist photographer. She serves on the board of Photo Op. John and Char, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
John, starting with you, you're one of the founders of Photo Op. Can you talk about the origin story and what inspired you to start this organization in your community?
Yeah, so it was founded between three of us, Graham Washaka and Mark Farrell. The idea came to us years and years ago, just really trying to create a community space and then also a photo community, you know, a dark room, a processing lab, be able to have a space for community to kind of gather and collect communal thoughts and be able to express themselves together.
What kind of response have you seen from the community in these first few years of Photo Op?
It's been great. You know, it's an evolving thing always. You know, anytime you start something new, and you start something that is not necessarily for you, it evolves. But it's been really, really fantastic. Just being able to have new programming, have new opportunities, be from education to career development to the arts. Things pop up all the time, and it's really, really great to both have a space for us to gather and create together. And then also for us to have a voice inside of the greater community.
And Char, you're involved with a lot of the programming at Photo Op. What kind of people come through your doors to participate in workshops and the community darkroom?
Yeah, we have all walks of life that come through these doors. Most people have some sort of interest in photography or visual arts, but their experience levels range anywhere from having never touched a camera before and interested in learning, all the way to professionals that have been in the industry for decades. And it's really about putting those people next to each other to learn and develop techniques and experiment and fail with their art form.
Do community members like feed off of each other's creativity and knowledge?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening in every single one of our programs.
And you're, from what I understand, a hobbyist photographer. Do you see Appleton through a new or different lens with all the photography going on?
I mean, definitely. As a hobbyist, I'm not like integrated into that professional field as much. And so I was doing a lot of art just on my own, like in my basement. And so then coming into Photo Op and meeting all of these new friends and people that share that passion has been a game changer.
What have you learned personally?
From a technical standpoint, the list goes on and on. It's very easy looking back over the last couple of years to see a change and just like an overall progression in my photography. But I mean, it's more about the people and talking to someone else about something and learning something completely new that I maybe would have never tried before, picking up a totally different camera, for example, or a totally different film stock.
So, John, Photo Op is housed in this 100-year-old former synagogue. Can you tell us about the space and how you've repurposed it?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful space. I love it personally. I love working in older buildings and that kind of stuff. So we basically purchased it from a church. It was for sale. I had been on the market for a while, and we really wanted to create something that was built for the community. And being able to repurpose an old building in a historic part of downtown Appleton is really great. We're in a neighborhood, so you know, there's only so much and so big we can get with it, but it works so well. We've been able to redo the upper chapel to be able to have it be work great for events and for art galleries and movie screenings and all that kind of stuff. So we did a lot of work. We were partnered with the Focus on Energy to get some grants, which was wonderful to help us fund some of it. But really a lot of it has just kind of come off of the backs of our local community and small donations and a lot of sweat equity, a lot of people donating time and energy. So yeah, upper space is gallery and event space. And then the lower level is like our workspace. And we have our dark room down there, a little shooting space, a place for meetings and small gatherings, photo setup, all that kind of stuff. So it works really, really well for what we're trying to do. And it's an inspiring place to be.
I'm thinking about how there might be generations now of people who've never stepped foot in a dark room, who don't know what a dark room is. Can you give us a tour?
The dark room is such a special place, especially to me. And I mean, you step foot into a room like that and, you know, the lights are dim. You've got that red amber light going on. You've got chemistry running and you're really working with a photograph that you intentionally slowed down and took. And now you're projecting it and then creating something tangible and genuine. And there's just something about that first time in the darkroom when you slide your print into the developer and you watch your image come up that's just magical.
Char, does it make you think differently about the camera on your smartphone?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I mean, today we're taking more pictures than we have ever before because of smartphones. But we spend so much less time with them. It's you're just kind of snapping, you're capturing moments. But when you put a camera, whether it's digital or film, in your hands, it gives you a second to slow down and intentionally think about the moment and the story that you're capturing. And then that kind of enters you into being more intentional about how you're communicating your perspective of the world and communicating that story to others.
And with developing, you know, there's nothing instantaneous. You have to wait and see how things turned out, you know. There's a mystery to it.
Yes. There's a mystery to it, and it really, you know, film is expensive as well, so it really makes you think before you click.
We're talking about Photo Op. It's a nonprofit organization and visual workspace for photographers, videographers as well in Appleton. And we have John Adams, who co-founded Photo Op, and Char Brandes, who sits on the board and helps to run events. John, you've worked in the film and video industry around the country, Chicago, New York, L.A. Now you're back in hometown. What drew you back to your hometown of Appleton?
That's interesting. I've always really liked this place. I love big cities. I love being able to travel. But when I came back a number of years ago, it was really a welcoming response to like being able to go and do things. I was running art galleries and photo stuff in other places, and it felt very hard to do in the sense that there's a lot of people that are out there doing it. And this community was really, really receptive to me coming in and really wanting to do something and do something and have that support. So I think the biggest thing about Appleton is in the Fox cities in general is it really embraces and is welcome to new ideas and new things and people who are, going out there and trying something, doing something a little bit different, and being really receptive to that.
Char, what is your take on the creative scene like in the Fox Cities?
I mean, it's one of the biggest reasons why I choose to stay here and live here in the Fox Cities. Especially just from a creative standpoint, people are just so receptive to creating and experimenting with art, and it's unlike any other city that I've really experienced when it comes down to that.
You know, Char, getting into photography as a hobby, it can seem a little bit intimidating. What advice do you have for someone who's curious about stepping into the world of photography, especially more of that old school film photography?
Starting any kind of new hobby, and especially when it comes to photography, can be so daunting. And I would say my biggest advice is all about people. Surrounding yourself with people who are doing the same things or are passionate about the same art form. I mean, especially photography, it can be so isolated, and being able to come together and share ideas and understand, even from the technical standpoints of what you're doing with film especially, is the best way to learn and grow in your hobby.
John, from an organizational standpoint, has it gotten more expensive to stock Photo Op with the rolls of film and the developing, you know, equipment? How does Photo Op keep this affordable for the community?
Yeah, it has. We definitely have really kind of grown into, you know, being able to open up our dark room just this, you know, this year. Our film, we do have like film sales that kind of offset some of that cost, but it is expensive. Really, it comes down to the grassroots effort of our community. Just coming out and supporting us from our local events, you know, from film screenings to art openings to small donations, recurring donations, all that kind of stuff really, really helps us grow. And we want to offer as much as we can for free. Obviously, nothing is free, and there are expenses, so we do need to make some money on stuff. But really, it's all about the experience. And as long as we can keep people coming in the door, we can grow our base of interested people, and not just interested in photography, really just interested in supporting community, supporting an art form, and supporting people that they surround themselves with is really important. And that's how we're going to continue to grow.
There's also talk of how this year being the year of analog, what kind of interest are you seeing from younger generations looking for a break from the digital world?
I'm seeing, for me, I love it. I've been talking to, we've been doing a lot of high school classes, field trips and that kind of stuff. And it's what I've been seeing is that the kids are really looking at just disconnecting for a little bit. They're trying to figure out something tangible, like Char was saying earlier, being able to go in the dark room or to be able to make a print and see a negative. Something like that is, I think, is really important. The ability to create an image with a cell phone these days is so easy, and it's come second nature to so many kids. So they already understand, you know, maybe how to pose or composition-wise, how to take a photo. But really slowing down and taking that moment and making something deliberate, I think is really, really important for the younger generation. And I think it's important for the older generation. I think it's important for everybody. I think we all want to disconnect right now a little bit from our phones, from our computers, and slow down and think about what we're doing.
That's exciting. You're getting into the classroom, into the high school.
Yeah. We've partnered so far with four different school districts, from Green Bay to Neenah, and that's in school programming that we've gone in and done, and then also field trips and classes and workshops outside of their school into our building.
And Char, looking at your online events calendar, Photo Op is a busy scene. You've got a film development night. You've got show and tell with local photographers, a book club. What are some of the workshops and other cool things that you have coming up?
Oh, yeah. We're very busy, especially moving into this year. We have high hopes and goals for this year. All of our programming is volunteer run. And this year, I'd say, like, some of the things that we're looking forward to is we launched a new program for a book club, a photo book club. And it's very community driven. People come in and bring a book, a photo book of some sort, and we sit down and we talk about what we like and share different photographers that we look up to. And it's a really awesome program. And then I'd also say our film development nights are a community favorite. And that's just a night where we all get together and develop our film together.
John, there are other communities listening to this wondering, what advice do you have for other, you know, cities around Wisconsin that want to create resources like yours to just fuel that local creativity and build new relationships?
Yeah, I think it's really an important thing to just start, just try something small. And really, our goal from the beginning was to create a little micro community with inside of our own thing. And now we're trying to grow that, you know, it starts with photography and video, and then maybe it grows to, you know, writing, because writing also has a place in filmmaking. And then it grows to animation. And like, so there is a way to grow it. But I think really just starting small and trying to look at and be receptive to what your community wants is really great. It really is it's just like taking a photo. It's everyone's like, oh, what's the best camera to use? And it's whatever camera you have. Like, take the picture, start the program, just try if it's something you believe in.
And then see what happens.
Absolutely.
Well, Char and John, thank you so much for joining us and sharing Photo Op.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. I really, really appreciate being here.
That is John Adams, freelance assistant director in Appleton and one of the co-founders of Photo Op, and Char Brandes, who serves on the board of Photo Op and is involved in programming. We've been talking about how Photo Op has sparked community connections and creativity with people learning about the art of film photography. And thanks to Don in Appleton for this suggestion. You can email us your story ideas. Send them to wisconsintoday@wpr.org. We just learned about a film photography nonprofit in Appleton that is drawing in community members with its darkroom and its film workshops. And thank you, Don, for your lead on this.
And we want to know if there's a project in your community that brings people together for a hands-on experience, whether it's photography or fiber arts, maybe cooking. Tell us about your experience in a hobby that's catching on where you are. What have you learned by being involved with the group? How does it make you feel? Have you met new people with shared interests?
We'd love to incorporate your story into a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Again, our number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Mackenzie Crummy, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.